So the starting point will be a problem in the calculus of variation, and the problem is understanding the asymptotic behavior as epsilon goes to zero of the variational problems which are generated by the following energies. So as you can see, the energy is defined on gradient fields, and it has a first part which somehow forces the gradient of u to have length 1, and it has a second part. So here, this is the Hilbert-Smith norm of the Hessian, which somehow forces a certain kind of smoothness. Epsilon goes to zero, so in a certain sense, this smoothness will be fading in the limit. And here we're speaking about maps which go, so functions u, which go from an open set omega over 2 to R. The open set is supposed to be, is assumed to be bounded and somehow as nice as you want, because the we will see quickly that the issue, at least up to now, is not concerned, it's not focused on boundary conditions. And okay, then of course to attach a variational problem to this, you have to assume some boundary conditions. And so the main point is somehow to understand what happens when you let epsilon goes to zero to minimizers of these functionals which are subjected to certain boundary conditions. Okay, so how does this link to the previous talk, as Felix anticipated? Well, unluckily, the notation is very inconsistent with Felix's talk. So we are in one of the toy models that you can derive from micromagnetics of thin films. So let's say that in the previous talk of Felix, M was identifying the magnetization, and now so we're assuming that actually this M is essentially two-dimensional. So what we're assuming is that what he called omega, so the thin film specimen, is somehow near to be a two-dimensional film, then somehow M as the third component, which is basically negligible, so let's say equal to zero. Okay, and then you remember that we had various terms in the energy functional, and the external field is supposed to be constant, so this is a constant. So and we had the penalizing term, which somehow was the following thing. So we had something like solving what was rational view. So somehow, okay. So this tells you that among the four parts of the energy, the one which concerns the exterior field is somehow negligible. So we throw away that part. So then there was another part which was penalizing the energy, which was penalizing somehow the distance of M from divergence-free vector fields, or more precisely, you also had some, so this is on omega, and then here you had something like M, start the perpendicular, equal to zero, and then okay. So, and then we were looking at the energy of. So this was one term of the energy that Felix wrote down, and now what we're assuming is that actually this constraint is satisfied. So actually that this vanishes. So this is equal to zero. And so what we're assuming is actually that here, instead of somehow looking at this energy, I mean at this term in the energy, what we're assuming is actually that the divergence of M is equal to zero, and M dot nu is equal to zero on the boundary, and that the modulus of M is equal to 1 on the boundary. Okay, so what we are left in the energy that somehow Felix wrote down are the two terms which are, so one is given by the gradient of M squared, and here there is somehow some constant, let's call it K, and then we have an isotropic energy which is of the form phi of m. Okay, and so now what happens is that the divergence of m is equal to zero, and we are in a two-dimensional case, so we can write m as the perpendicular of the gradient of a certain function u, which unluckily is the same u which is written over there. But okay, so now we switch to our notation, so let us forget about that. And now u is what he called before psi. And okay, so now if we make this somehow, if we consider this stream function, then what happens here is that we get something which depends on the, so which is somehow the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of the Eschen of u to the square, and then we have this anisotropic energy. Okay, and an isotropic energy which I have is precisely 1 minus gradient of u squared. Okay, and then somehow I'm playing with the parameter, and I'm writing the energy in a slightly different way, dividing by constant. And this will be clear why somehow, because in this, because we will see that this is somehow quite natural. Okay, so the motivations for studying this, as you have seen, I mean, it can be derived as a toy model from micromagnetics, but it was proposed actually earlier. It was proposed by Aviles and Giga, at least as far as I know, for the first time in 1987, and it was connected to smectically with crystals. And then it was proposed later by Gioia and Ortiz in connection with somehow thin films, which are under biaxial compression. Okay, and then of course the fourth motivation is somehow that this functional is somehow a higher order generalization of functionals which of course you have seen and you will see during this conference, and that have successfully studied in the past years with certain techniques. So it's kind of natural to ask what we can say about these things. Okay, to understand more precisely what is the goal of our somehow asymptotic analysis, let us let us make a crude analysis of what happens when epsilon goes to zero. So when epsilon goes to zero, this is forcing the constraint modulus of gradient of u is equal to one. Okay, and then you have to remember that we have some boundary condition to enforce. So of course, usually what happens is that if we solve the equation modulus of gradient of u is equal to one subject to some boundary condition, we find many solutions. Basically, in almost all cases, almost all these solutions have to have some discontinuity. For example, if you take, somehow here I've drawn an example, which is somehow omega is an ellipse, and we impose boundary conditions equal to zero for the function u, then if we solve the iconal equation, somehow the best thing that we have, that we can do at least from a certain point of view, is to take the distance function, which is the viscosity solution of the iconal equation. But even the viscosity solution will create a certain discontinuity in the gradient. So here, somehow, you will see some kind of roof, which is going to have a discontinuity at the level of the gradients in this line here. Okay, so what we can imagine is that anyway we have this other term, which is penalizing somehow the non-smoothness of u. So what we can imagine is that somehow we want a limiting variational problem which is defined on solutions of the iconal equation, which hopefully is selecting the limit of minimizers of this function. So what we are somehow, what is our ansatz is that if we take minimizers take minimizers of these functionals, they will actually converge to a solution of the iconal equation. And to understand what is the limit of these minimizers, we have to single out a variational principle which is defined among all solutions of the iconal equation. And this variational principle will tell us that we don't want to create too many discontinuities, because if we create too many discontinuities, then we are going to pay a huge amount of energy here, and that is not possible for a minimizer. Okay, so all of this. Was conjectured by Aviles and Giga in 87, and let us and they also conjectured what the shape of the energy should be. So they conjectured that somehow, if let us assume now, just for the sake of argument, that the limit of these minimizers or the limit of some functions u epsilon such that f epsilon u epsilon is bounded away from infinity, let us assume that this function satisfies the Eikonal equation, and somehow it's a nice solution of the Eikonal equation, which is smooth outside the one-dimensional set, and then has a jump of the gradient in this set. So somehow here, as you can see, our example, and in our example, the gradient is discontinuous, but it has a well-defined right and left trace on this line. Okay, then what they conjecture is that somehow the limit of minimizers of those functionals should be minimizer of the following functional. So this is the integral over the discontinuity set of gradient of u of the modulus of the difference between the left and right trace to the cube, integrated on the in the length, so the first Hausdorff measure. Okay, so now I will give you a little survey of what are the non-rigorous results on this. So this is the slide for somehow people who know or work on gamma convergence. So for those people, this slide is somehow summarizing what has been rigorously proved in the framework of gamma convergence. And okay, so for explaining these results to somehow non-experts in gamma convergence, what happens is that, okay, so first of all, we can prove that minimizers are converging strongly in W13 to solutions of the Eikonal equation. More precisely, our result is that, so this was proved by myself and Ambrosio and Mantegazza in 99 and by De Simone, Kohn, Müller, and Dotto at the same time with slightly different proofs. And so more precisely, what we can prove is that if we have a sequence u epsilon, which is somehow such that f epsilon u epsilon is bounded away from infinity, then u epsilon is strongly precompact in W13. And so the limit satisfies the Eikonal equation. Okay, then there is, at least in our paper, there is the conjectured asymptotic energy, which we have written for somehow piecewise smooth function. So we have a relaxation for that functional, and to this relaxation, so somehow we have a certain function space which includes piecewise smooth solution of the Eikonal equation, but which is a little bit larger. And on this functional, on this space, we have a functional which extends the one which we have written before, and to this we can apply direct methods of the calculus of variation. And then we have some partial result on understanding if this functional is the real, somehow, limiting selecting energy, which would provide the full understanding of the variational problem. And, okay, so it's not a complete proof, so it's not a complete gamma convergence proof, in particular to experts of gamma convergence. It will be clear that here we don't have the, somehow, gamma Lim-Sup inequality for every function. And okay, in a nutshell, what these results tell us is that, okay, if there is a reasonable energy which makes the job, so if there is a reasonable energy which is going to give you a variational principle which selects the right limit of the limit of the minimizers, then if there is such an energy, it has to be the one which has been conjectured by Avides and Giga. Okay, so instead of somehow going into these results, I want just to give you somehow what is the main ingredient, at least the main non-technical ingredient in this in the proofs of all these results. So we're going to speak about entropies in the following sense. So this is a calculation which was first performed by Jean and Kohn in 99. So assume you have a solution of modulus of gradient of u is equal to 1, and assume that u is smooth. Then actually, you can easily show, but just by using the chain rule, that these solutions also satisfy the following partial differential equation. Okay, that is not a surprise. Every time that you have, well, not every time, because of course when you're going to speak about systems, this is not true, as was pointed out in the talk by Jan Brenier. But at least at the level of a single equation, this is almost every time true. When you have a first-order PDE for a certain function u, then a nonlinear first-order PDE, then you have many other things which, for example, the Fermos call companion balance laws, which are automatically satisfied by smooth solution. So so the Itonal equation is an example, and many other examples can be somehow derived from the theory of hyperbolic conservation laws for one scalar equation. So, and in the theory of hyperbolic conservation laws, balance laws are connected to the concept of entropy, entropy flux. So that is why we're calling these things entropies. Anyway, what is true is that if you have a smooth solution, and so you can use the chain rule, then you get also that your function U satisfies a hierarchy of other first-order PDEs. Well, okay, in this case it's not even first-order, but anyway, a hierarchy of other PDEs. Okay, now what happens when you have a discontinuity? Well, when you have a discontinuity, you cannot apply anymore the chain rule. And actually what happens is that what happens when you have a discontinuity is that it's no longer true that to set notation, let us say that I call phi an entropy if phi is a smooth map from R2 to R2, such that for any smooth solution of the Itonal equation, I also have this other PDE satisfied. Okay, now what happens is that when U is piecewise C1, the divergence of this phi calculated in gradient of U is actually usually a one-dimensional measure which is supported on the set of discontinuity. Okay, so what Jin and Kohn pointed out is that, if we take a solution of the Itonal equation, and let's say it's piecewise smooth, then this divergence of phi of gradient of u, the norm of this measure, so the total variation of this measure, can be estimated by a constant which depends only on phi times the functional of u, the functional evaluated on u. And moreover, if there exists a u epsilon which converges to u strongly in W13, for example, such that F epsilon U epsilon is uniformly bounded, then actually F of U is also uniformly bounded. So what happens when you have strong convergence of U epsilon to a certain function of function U is that actually though the function U from what we know before satisfies the Itonal equation, we also note that the divergence of phi composed with red U is a measure which satisfies a certain natural bound in terms of the limiting functional. And moreover, what they pointed out is that in a certain sense, knowing all these norms for a certain number of phis actually means is equal to know this quantity f of u. So more precisely, some of these phis calibrate f of u, which means that this inequality is in a certain sense sharp. And so if we know the total variation of norm of the measures divergence of phi of grade u, we are able to compute this f of u. Now, what happens is that all of this is actually done, at this level, was done for piecewise smooth functions. So all the things which I've said here are true for piecewise smooth function. In a certain sense, now it's natural to understand what would be a weak setting for our variational problem. So remember that we had this conjectured limit, which is given. Which I can write down again. So we have this conjectured limit, which you can write as f of u is equal to integral over the jump of this quantity. And now what I'm telling you is that when u, so this is of course defined when u is piecewise smooth, and then what I'm telling you is that when u is piecewise smooth, it's actually also true that, it's actually true that f of u is in some sense some kind of supremum of divergence of phi of gradient of u as measures in a certain sense. So this I don't want to be precise here because it's going to be technical, but in a certain sense it's supremum of all these measures. Okay, so this gives you somehow, so this guy is defined just for functions who are piecewise smooth, but as you see, this kind of so then we have this equality when u is piecewise smooth, and then we can just say, okay, let us take the solution of the iconal equation such that the divergence of phi of grad u are measures, and then let us write our functional in this way. And then we have something which we can write for somehow a broad class of solution of the iconal equation without knowing any kind of smoothness for grad u. And this functional coincides with the one which we like when we have smooth functions. So it provides naturally a, somehow a weak notion of our functional for a broad class. And why do we want to do this is because, of course, functions which are piecewise smooth do not enjoy any kind of compactness. So if we wish to apply the direct methods of calculus variation to this functional, then we have to find some kind of extension on a space which is compact. Okay, and the results which I have showed you before, they prove that actually this new functional defined in this new function space is lower semi-continuous, and it has good coercivity properties, and then a minimizer exists in this new class by direct methods of the calculus of variation. So let us, so this is summarized here. No, it's not the supremum of the norm of the measure, so that is why I didn't want to write it. It's more complicated. So you take the total variation, you take the measure, which is the total variation of the measures, and then you make some kind of supremum of measures, which is more complicated, which means that you have to take partitions, countable partitions, then to each partition you associate a different measure. You compute mu I of AI, you sum over I, and then you take the supremum over all partitions. Different measures means different entropy. It's a sort of point-wise supremum of your measures, right? Because, okay, so what is hidden here is that if you have a smooth curve, right, and if you choose the right phi according to what is the tangent of to the curve in that point, then you get something which looks like the functional, but only in a small ball around that point. So that is why I didn't want to be more precise. Okay, so here it is. You take epsilon. So let us. This is the weak setting in more precise words. You call E the entropies phi for modulus of gradient of u is equal to 1. So recall that. The definition of the entropies is that when u is smooth and satisfies the Hamiltonian equation, then this equation is automatically satisfied. Then you take the set of functions which satisfy the Hamiltonian equation such that mu phi, as defined in this way, is actually a measure for every phi in the set of entropies. And then you define this your functional f of u in this some kind of supremum. Okay, and then you have existence of minimizers, and you also have all the gamma convergence. This is hidden in the algebraic calculations, which somehow gives you this thing here. I should show the calculation, which I don't have time to see how you select the C phi. Anyway, this is going to give you the right functional if you choose appropriately these C phi. So you have to choose the sharp ones, of course. You have to choose the ones which give you the sharp inequalities. Sorry? No, that does not depend on, that depends on the functional f, but on, that does not depend on the particular functions which you have chosen. Okay, but that depends on the functional f, right. And it works with that particular function, I mean, with modulus of gradient of u plus minus modulus of gradient of u minus to the cube. Doesn't work with anything else. Okay, now that we have this, somehow there's a natural question which arises and is, okay, we have this fancy space. What can we say about the function on that fancy space? I mean, can we say that at least in some weak sense, the function is sufficiently smooth outside the one-dimensional set, and we can compute the functional, which is defined in that fancy way, as this guy, which is the guy we started with. Okay, so this is a very natural question for various reasons. Okay, so there are some internal motivations, and the internal motivation is that such a theorem would provide somehow some kind of regularity theory for your functions, and would also somehow complete a classical path in the calculus of variations, which is from classical to weak to almost classical formulation. And then it would probably also be a first step towards closing the problem of somehow rigorously proving via gamma convergence that actually this functional is the one which captures the asymptotic limit of the functionals which we started with. Okay, but now then there's a natural question which arises. Okay, so which at least many people would ask me is that, okay, now we know a function space. So I have this fancy function space which is written in that way, but we know another function space which is the following. So we satisfy not only the Iconal equation but also gradient of u is BV, in which we would have some kind of compactness, we would have some kind of weak notion of what is the sect of discontinuity. And we also would have, and this is maybe not so known, a way of computing our functional in terms of supremum, to compute it in terms of somehow pointwise behavior of your function. So let me state this more precisely. If you have a BV function V, so now V is going to be in our setting the gradient of U. Actually, you can identify a co-dimension one rectifiable set. So rectifiable means countable union of C1 of pieces of C1 surfaces, such that V has right and left trace there, and outside every point x is a back point. So I mean this set would be really what we call jump set of the function, and in a certain sense this is a geometric measure theory way of saying that BV functions are piecewise smooth. And then there's another thing which is maybe less known, which is, okay, there's a rule which is called Bodker chain rule, which allows you to calculate, to compute the derivatives of composition of the function V with smooth functions. And this rule tells you that, okay, when you decompose your derivative of the BV function into a part which is somehow diffuse part and the part which is the atomic part, so in one line it would be really Dirac masses versus widespread measures. In this case, in the higher dimensional case, would be the measure which lives on the jump set and the measure which somehow is more widespread. Then what happens is that the Wolber chain rule tells you, okay, the measures which are more widespread are somehow there. The chain rule is the usual one. On the other one is the one which you expected when you have jumps. So to understand what is the derivative of f of u, you have to compute f of the right trace, f of the left trace, and then you have to take the difference between these two guys, and okay, then you have this fancy writing when you're doing higher dimensional things. Okay, so the point is that why don't we try to compare our result with BV functions? So why don't we try to prove that in the limit, somehow our variational setting corresponds to considered BV function? Well, the reason is that this is not true. There's no BV estimate, and this was proved first in our joint work with Ambrosio and Mantegazza. And so if we take the original functionals, f epsilon u epsilon, and we have a bound from above, u epsilon is converging to a certain u, but we can provide examples such that the limiting gradient of u is not in BV. Well, anyway, let me give you a quantitative estimate on how much this is true or how much we failed to be in BV. And this quantitative estimate is the following. So by work of Bertam and Javin, in which they were using some velocity averaging lemmas and so some more connections with conservation laws, they could prove that the gradient of u is in W 1/3 3/2. But with what I could prove with Michael Weck-Stiegenberg in somehow a more refined a refinement of our previous example is that actually gradient of u is not better than W 1/3 3 in general, 1/3 3. And okay, so one side remark is that this gives you the almost optimality of the velocity averaging lemmas that they are using there, which was an open problem. Okay, so now we are left, somehow we know that we cannot apply BV, but now we are left with a problem which I want to generalize here. So that is why I call it somehow structure theorem or nonlinear structure theorem and nonlinear versions of the BV chain rule of Volpert. So the general problem, somehow the problem which I've stated there, which is, okay, I have this class of function spaces, I have this function, this class of functions, can I identify some kind of can I say in some geometric measure theoretic sense that these functions are piecewise smooth? So can I prove some kind of regularity for this function space? And okay, now the kind of regularity which I want to prove is the one of the BV structure theorem, which I call the Georgi Federer Fleming structure theorem. And it could be somehow, it could be recast in this very general framework. Assume that you have a certain function u from Rk to Rn, and assume that for many entropies, phi, so E is somehow any class of C-infinity maps which you give me, assume that we have the divergence of phi of V is a measure. So can I say that something like the Georgi Federer Fleming structure theorem holds? Of course, I cannot say it in such generality, so what are the conditions that I have to ask on E so to get such a structure theorem? Okay, and then assume that this is true. Then can I give you a way of computing the divergence of composition of V with this function phi? So can I not only say that, okay, they have this special structure, but can I also compute in terms of this structure the divergence of phi of V? Okay, what are the motivations for this one? I mean, there are not only the motivations which come from my problem, but this is somehow a more general problem which could have potentially very nice applications in other fields. So one field is, for example, the theory of hyperbolic conservation laws. So this would provide you, for example, a theory of regularity for scalar conservation laws, which allow for rough initial data, because, okay, we know that when we start from BV initial data, we stay BV, and which allow also somehow as a difference towards the usual entropy conditions, it allows also somehow the divergence of this phi of V to be a general measure, a measure with sign. In the theory of the hyperbolic, in the theory of scalar conservation laws, one usually considers Kruskov solutions in which actually knows that the divergence of some of these phis are actually non-negative measures. But there are also theories which consider under-compressive solutions in which the divergence of these things are somehow allowed to be to have also a sign, right? And in that case, there is no BV theory which applies, and then somehow you're left with a solution which is in L infinity, and which you would expect to have at least some of the features of the Kruskov solution, meaning it has codimension one shocks and so on. Then a second application, which would be which would be much more interested, we have the solutions which are somehow achieved by compensated compactness, starting from the work of Diperna on 2×2 systems of conservation laws in one dimension. And those are the only solutions which are known to exist for high initial data. And these solutions are somehow do not have any kind of regularity. They are just L infinity. I mean, here we don't even have the Bezov for somehow fractional Sobolev regularity that we have with velocity averaging lemmas for scalar conservation laws with rough initial data. Okay, and that somehow answering to this kind of question would provide the first regularity theory for this. And then there is a third connection which I just want to mention, but it's much further somehow because it cannot be recast in that framework. But okay, the problems which arise here could have this connection. I just want to mention that you find this connection in these two papers. And okay, here I also give you where exactly you can find this connection. And this is also could be a very nice application of these kind of problems. Okay, now let me tell you about the answers. So we have some answers at least in some of these cases. So one theorem is the following. The first theorem is in a joint work with Felix, and it concerns the function space for the which is somehow the relaxation of the initial functional. I don't have the class S, unluckily. Okay, anyway, you remember that the class S is the class of functions which allowed me to define this fancy functional and which allows me to apply the direct methods of the calculus of variation. And we have a theorem which says, yes, in a certain sense, there is a codimension one set on which I see this continuity, and outside this set I have some smoothness of my function. And then this in certain sense answer to the first problem for that particular class, and it's so somehow the first nonlinear version of the Federer-Fleming or the Georgi structure theorem, but we don't have the Volper chain rule. At least we don't have a complete Volper chain rule. So what we can say is that yes, the functional f or my measure mu phi's will look like the right part on this chump set, on this set of discontinuity, but potentially there could be some other part of the measure which is living outside, though not having such a concentration. So we're not able somehow to close the circle and to say that, yes, the functional which we have written is actually some kind of natural generalization of the previous one. Okay, then there's the second theorem, which is answering to the, again, to the first problem in a different case, and this is the case of scalar conservation laws. So let me somehow, this is the precise statement of the theorem. Some assumptions on F are needed, so here, just for the people who know the theory of scalar conservation laws, this would be somehow a regularity theory for solutions of scalar conservation laws independent on which initial data you start with. Okay, that is, of course, not possible if you have a linear scalar conservation law, right? Because if you have a transport equation and you solve the Cauchy problem, then you get as much as regularity as you started with. But when the function is nonlinear and the characteristics are so clustering somewhere, we know from velocity averaging lemmas that actually we get some extra regularity because of the regularization effects of nonlinearity. Well, this is pretty much the same, but we have a more qualitative somehow regularity theorem, which tells you that if you solve the scalar conservation law, and in this case somehow it could be even a generalized scalar conservation law, so it doesn't have to have some time dependence, which is, so it doesn't have to have a certain particular variable, which is the time, then if we have the set of entropies for the scalar conservation laws, and we know that our weak solution gives entropy production, which are measures, even time measures, then we can again say that our function is more or less smooth outside, in a certain sense, outside codimension one set, and the codimension one set is actually the set of shocks of our conservation laws, and you can interpret the shock in some more classical way. And again, even here, we have some relations between the entropy productions and the traces of the function at that point, but we cannot prove that the entropy production lives only on the jump set, which would be somehow the counterpart of the Volper chain rule, the full counterpart of the Volper chain rule. Sure. Yeah? No. We don't have countering sense. When I say we cannot prove it, that's because we don't know how to prove it. Okay. Well, then there's a third case in which actually we are able to prove even the Volper chain rule, but it's a very particular toy case. So now we start with the conservation law, which is one-dimensional, and we take entropy, so Kruskov solutions of the conservation law, so the entropy production, at least for certain entropies, are non-negative measures. But then we are in a non-trivial case, but in a case in which regularity, BV regularity is not known, so F can have inflection points. In particular, F is not convex, because if it were strictly convex, then we could apply Olenek estimate and we would know BV regularity. But now F is not convex, and we have certain assumptions on X. In particular, we have a generally nonlinear assumption, so F is not going to be linearly degenerate, otherwise propagation of singularities. And okay, in this case, we can prove that there is a shock set. Outside this shock set, actually, we have Lebesgue point, which is another place in which I cheated. I mean, we had this fancy vanishing mean oscillation, which looks like Lebesgue point, but it's not precisely Lebesgue point. So in this case, we have stronger regularity outside. And again, also this vanishing mean oscillation, which is somehow, which we have from the previous theorem, we think it's not there, actually. We think it's fully a Lebesgue point, but we're not able to prove. Then we have that U has traces on J, so right and left trace, and then we have a full Volpert chain rule for the entropy productions. So we can actually prove that the entropy measures are living on the shocks. So the entropy measures are really computed in some kind of classical way as if the function were piecewise motion. Okay, so this is almost all, but before closing, let me tell you that at least in some cases, similar theorems have appeared at the same time. Okay, so related works. So first of all, there is a related work, which is the first one, and it's again another variational problem, which is connected to micromagnetics and which is somehow similar to the one which I have showed you, and it was first considered by Rivière and Serfati, and Rivière and Serfati made pretty much the same kind of analysis, so they identified a weak a variational problem in the limit, which can be seen as an extension of a natural variational problem, which you can define on piecewise smooth functions. And so there we have this exactly the same issue. I mean, some kind of function space which looks like BV, but it's not really BV because there are some nonlinearities inside, and you want to ask if you have the same kind of properties. And it was proved by Ambrosio, Kirchheim, Lecumberia, Rivière, the same kind of theorem that we have with Felix, except that it relies on a completely different proof. So some parts of the proof are similar, but other parts are more related to the connections with viscosity solutions of Hamilton-Jacobi equations. So what happens is that in that case, it doesn't seem that, for example, their techniques can be extended to the higher dimensional case or can be extended to handle, for example, the conservation laws when they have inflection points or non-convexity. Okay, then in a further paper by Lecumberia and Rivière, these methods has been generalized to one-dimensional conservation law where F is strictly convex. And of course, now if you just consider a Kirchhoff solution, then you would have BV bounds. But they're considering a solution in which the entropy production is just a Radon measure, so it has under-compressive shocks. And then the theorem is, again, non-trivial because you don't have any BV bound for that. Actually, you can prove that there are no BV bounds. Okay, and let me just mention that this is connected to the very nice work by Ambrosio, Lecumberia, and Rivière, in which they showed somehow that there is an interesting connection among the limiting variational problem, which they are considering, and the viscosity solution. In particular, they show that the viscosity solution is the only minimizer of the variational problem which they have in the limit. And now let me also tell you that this is in the case that I consider is false. So in my case, it's conjectured that if you start from a convex shape and you assume the right boundary data, then the limiting variational problem will select the viscosity solution of the iconal equation. But Jean and Kohn showed by an example that there are at least a certain shapes for which, yes, the viscosity solution is a minimizer, but there is another guy who is a minimizer, and it's not the viscosity solution. So, thank you.